This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Every team, every topic, everywhere. This is Believe.
Hey, this is Kenny Mayne, and you're in the press row.
Welcome to the press row. Behind the scenes stories from the world of sports media. Press row. Inside and interviews from around the sports world. Now, here's your host, Jonas Siegel.
About a year and a half ago, I went to go see Bruce Springsteen here in Seattle, and had the fortune of running into a legend, Kenny Mayne from ESPN, and started talking to him. He was sitting next to me, and to my luck and yours, he decided and graciously agreed to come on the podcast. And while it took a long time to get him to come on, the benefit of that meeting is today. So sit back, relax, enjoy, and get to hear the story of Kenny Mayne, the football player, Kenny Mayne, the broadcaster, and just generally a really good guy, Kenny Mayne. Sit back. Here he is, Kenny Mayne. Awesome. Welcome back. Jonah here in Seattle in the press row. Thrilled you are joining us once again. And I don't say this very often, but you are amongst legends. You know, if you grew up in the era that I did, and I'm now dating my guest, you grew up a sports fan with kind of two entities. The first, to me, that with all due respect, guest, was CNN. And the folks over there really brought sports highlight shows into my life, with all due respect. Fred Hickman, Nick Charles, that show was an incredible memory of my life. That's how I first really got my foot. Even though I'm Canadian, growing up in Toronto, that's how I really learned about sports highlight shows. And then the second was the early days of ESPN. And you can't think of ESPN without thinking of my guest today, Kenny Mayne. Kenny, how are you?
I'm well. And also, don't leave out George Michael's Sports Machine. So you remember that?
Of course. But
I was at the time just out of college, and I was working as sort of a gopher at a station in Seattle. They call it a PA now, production assistant. And then I was a writer and a producer, and it took forever to get on TV. But anyway, I remember we needed highlights. You know, we were a small independent station, so we had to record other channels to get our video, right? And you hit it on the head. You had the CNN guys, you had the ESPN guys before I got there, and the George Michael Sports Machine, I believe it was called. He had the big fake gigantic machine that he'd press the button and cool highlights would happen.
But until then, it was like you had the 6 o'clock news, the nightly news, and then there was just a sports segment. There were no dedicated sports shows. And then all of a sudden, these entities created, I think it was first just a half hour show. And then all of a sudden, you had headline news, Van Earl Wright comes along, and sure, voila, sports radio starts, and a cottage industry is born.
Yeah, I mean, when ESPN started, which was 1979, I was at UNLV playing football. That was my junior year. And I remember, and I was into sports. You know, like I said, I played football. I was sports all my life. And I thought it was so dumb. I was like, who in the hell cares about sports that much? I certainly didn't. Nobody wants 24 hours worth of sports. And I was wrong, as it turns out, you know, because they went from that. I don't know if you remember the old ESPN days. They'd do their programming, but they couldn't fill the 24 hours. So I think they shared time in markets with others, like a business channel, or, you know, like as you grew up, my era, when the TV people were done with doing TV, they put up color bars or an American flag or whatever.
Test right? Pattern, right?
But the funny part is, years later, when I was trying to put myself in front of ESPN, and I was freelancing forever and trying to beat down the door, and they weren't listening, I sent a letter to John Walsh, one of the head guys there, And I said, hey, can you check the appropriate box? I'm trying to sort out my career. Because I was working in a sales job and freelancing in TV, mostly for ESPN, but for others, TSN, Canada, Prime, NBA Entertainment. You know, whoever would pay me, I would do it, right? And I was trying to get to ESPN. So I sent John Walsh this letter, check the appropriate box. I'm trying to sort out my career. And the first one said, stand by the mailbox. Contract's on the way. Second one said, keep up the good freelance working. Third one said, we'll hire you about the time ESPN 5 hits the air. And they checked the middle box, and he wrote, keep up the good work, Kenny, you know, stay in touch, or whatever he said. I ended up getting hired literally like 2 months later. So I have no, I've never really gotten to the bottom of, did that wake them up like, hey, come on, we've been freelancing this guy forever. He wrote a funny note, let's hire him. Or was it all just coincidental? ESPN 2 was about 6 months old, maybe 9 months old. They needed another body. And somehow that was me.
So let's just pause for 1 second and go back. Am I right? Did you grow up in the greater Seattle area? Is this home where I am? Is this home?
I was born in Tacoma at St. Joe's. I grew up a couple different houses as a little kid, but mostly the South End and mostly Kent, Washington, South 272nd, right off the freeway. When we got a freeway on ramp, exit ramp, we thought modern society had arrived. We didn't have one before. You had to drive to Des Moines or back to Federal Way. And we used to use the stoplight there to start our bike races. So we'd have like five guys on bikes and you'd look up and the lights would be the signal to, you know, that was our go. Side story. So yeah, Star Lake is where I grew up. And, you know, it was like kind of country back then. Our road had curves to it and then they put in the freeway thing, and now it's like a super highway practically going down to Kent Valley. But yeah, we always identified more with Seattle. I mean, we could get there in 20 minutes or less.
Right.
Sonic Games, Pilots, the Seattle Pilots of 1969. But yeah, I kind of split time, Tacoma, Seattle, Federal Way, Kent.
All right, and then yada, 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 you're a quarterback at UNLV.
Very good. I could throw, but I was a better thrower than a quarterback. I've come to realize. I wish I had been better at everything, but it's too late now. So I left UNLV. I was like second string. I ruined my ankle my junior year, so I kind of came away limping. But I got a tryout with the Seahawks. I actually signed a contract. I got to throw to Steve Largent for my tryout, which is beneficial. And I remember Dick Mansberger, their player director, said the quarterback coach, Jim Rome, said, you weren't terrible, so we're going to go ahead and offer you. And I just signed it. I didn't even look at it. Whatever it was, I signed. And Dave Craig's still pissed that I actually got more in my second year than, or I never got it, but I was going to get more than what he signed for. But I failed the physical on day one at Cheney because of my ankle and got a TV job like 5 days later, 7 days later, whatever it was, out of the newspaper. This is back in the day where they had want ads. I guess they still do, but, you know, they were used more readily than they are today, I think. And it said looking for college experience and, you know, broadcasting degree, blah, blah, blah. That was me. Got hired over the phone, and I now have a job 4 hours a night, 5 days a week, because we didn't have news on the weekends. We always joked if there's news on the weekends, it's news to us. That was going to be our company motto. And it took a while. You know, most people, if they want to be on TV, they'd, you know, start out smaller, right? You'd go to Bend, Oregon or Tri-Cities, Washington or somewhere, right? I just happened to kind of fall into the job that I just described, the kind of gopher assistant job. And I was like, why do I have to go anywhere? I'm just going to stay here until they give me my chance. I didn't really think it through all that way. I didn't know it would take so long. But it took like 4 years. So now I'm mid-high 20s, 26-ish. And now I'm doing real news. I'm doing like stories about the Green River Killer or the Seattle City Council or, you know, like hard news stuff, right? Or feature stories. And then they added a weekend show and Jack Eddy, my boss, was like, well, you played football, you're doing sports. And I honestly, that wasn't my intention at all. I wanted to be working for Frontline by now or making Ken Burns documentaries, probably not as good as his, but it just kind of happened the way it happened.
So you end up at ESPN. You seem like a very confident individual. What was it like walking in there?
Well, confident and not confident day one for sure. Cause you know, I hadn't been on live TV in 5 years. I'd done a bunch of freelance field reporting type stuff for, like I said, all the different entities, mostly ESPN. And what happened really was Keith Olbermann moved over to ESPN 2 and was with Susie Colbert wearing the leather jacket. He wanted to go back to 1 and be with Dan Patrick again. So he leaves. Stuart Scott moves up to the chair next to Susie, and they literally needed one more guy. So I have Keith to thank for all that. And I go back there, a couple weeks of training or, you know, immersing into the culture there. And on day one, I'm going to be on TV now. They have a system, every company has a different computer system. And there's, I think it was called Basis. It looked like old discarded Soviet era equipment. It was like, I mean, and I'm not very technical, as you found out with me trying to figure out the buttons on this feed here. It wasn't really my fault though. And I couldn't figure out how to save my stories. So my job was called the smash anchor. Bill Pito, Deb Kaufman, and me, right? We're the smash anchors. We would come on at the bottom of at 28 or 58, or sometimes 25 or 55, right? We do either 2 minutes or 5 minutes. And I'm getting ready for my first one. It's going to be on at 5:55 or whatever time it was that day. And I couldn't figure out how to save my writing. I was writing my little lead-ins and then the highlight, lead-in, highlight, whatever I was doing. And Julie Mariosh, I'll never forget, my producer, comes up and she kind of puts her hand on my shoulder and said, is everything okay? And it's like 5:15. There's nothing in the rundown that looks like I've done any work because I can't figure out which button and I'm too afraid to ask or too dumb to do it. So I literally, she teaches me quickly now. Oh, okay, I got it now. But I had at 5:20 maybe a brief flirtation with, if I run from this building right now, just go. No one ever knows that I suck and that I failed. But I stayed. So I'm glad I stayed.
So memory fails me right now, but there was a really cool, and I think it was Aaron Sorkin TV show.
Yeah. Sports Night.
Back in Sports Night. And part of what made that show so spectacular was the culture of the network.
Mm-hmm.
Did that exist at ESPN back then, or was it just?
You know, they had their version of it. Their place was much smaller. It wasn't perfect, but how can it be? Like, we weren't like, oh, that's not how we do it. You know, it wasn't like that so much as just they did it in miniature, sort of. And the story I had heard is Sorkin was writing something else. I forget what. And he was up all night, and SportsCenter was always on, and it just hit him like, shit, I should make a show about that. People would get it, you know. And I thought it was a good show. It was fun. They were funny, and, you know, it did its thing. The culture, I mean, there's like subcultures, you know, like the whole, it's not all just one group doing the same thing. There's all these different, and I probably, you know, if you compare it to high school or something, I was slightly on the out, not on the outs, but I'm over there with the theater kids, right?
You weren't with the cool kids? That's what you're saying?
Well, I was and I wasn't. Like, the cool kids liked me and mentored me, Bob Lee and Charlie Steiner and Dan Patrick. And all, like, I was accepted in that sense. But because I probably did it less conventionally than many were used to, they always kind of, I mean, forever. The whole 27 years, they always looked like, oh, what the fuck's he going to do? Oh, God, here it comes, you know. And then it turned out what I did mostly was okay. I wasn't perfect. I made my share of mistakes. But like the best example is the Upfronts. That's the big advertising spectacle they have every year in New York City. And all the advertisers and agencies and producers want to come and they listen to the song and dance from each network about why we're so great and why you should advertise with us, right? And one year they decided to stick me out there. And I think that was almost the biggest breakthrough. It was like, go do what you want to do. Like, be you. Make fun of what's happening. We're not going to edit you. I could even swear. I was like, really? You want me to swear at 9 a.m. for a breakfast meeting? I'm like, okay, go ahead. So that was a little more substantiation of they finally sort of believed, like, all right, we trust him with the keys. But over time, to your earlier point, yeah, the more you do something, like, I think the more confident you get. You know, I had my good nights and bad nights. There was still nervousness. Every show you had a little bit of nervousness, especially if you had shows where there was a serious story. I mean, I worked the night Kobe Bryant died. You know, you're like on your toes, like, do not screw this up, say it properly and be not that I wouldn't be respectful about that, but you know what I'm saying, like, it's far different than screwing up a hockey highlight and making fun of yourself.
Covering real stories, not sports stories.
Yeah, but the thing is, I really did grow up and was training to be more serious, even though I think I have a sense of humor. But that was my goal, is to be doing international news or documentaries or whatever. It just happened that I fell into sports, and then that became, I probably liked it more because it was easier, if I'm really honest. You know, you're just calling games. It ain't that big a deal. And, but you still have to be diligent. You got to get the names right and study up a little bit and, you know, try to, it was always like the doctor's credo of, what is it? Like, first do no harm.
Right.
You know, get the score right, get the winner right, get the names right, get the stats right, and then screw around. Stuart Scott had the best way to get around that problem of some of the bosses. One in particular would, like, guys, you got to be more serious out there. Like, we got hardcore sports fans, all this kind of stuff. You guys are out there clowning around. So Stuart would just crush them, overload them with factual information. He had so many this, and then the last six games that, and on and on and on. Then he'd get in his booyahs and whatever else he wanted to do. But, you know, it was always an acquired taste, I think, with me, because I, even though they had a lot of really funny guys, Bill Patrick, Dan Patrick, Keith Olbermann, Bob Lee has a great sense of humor, Charlie Steiner, you know, I could go on and on. There was still something, and I think also it was always this thing of, he used to assemble garbage cans and now he's working here. So, like, you know, I was like 20 to 1 coming in to get hired in the first place, and I stayed around for a good while.
I understand that when you left, or you announced you were leaving, Stuart Scott's kids were amongst the first to reach out to you. Is that true?
I think they, it was funny, for some reason I bumped into the Twitter feed of the day I wrote my I'm leaving ESPN. And I think you're right. I think they were quick. They were one or two or three. Yeah. Taylor and Sydney. And in fact, I just heard from Taylor the other day. We've been trying to meet up and we keep missing each other on the phone. She says, can I call you this weekend? And I said, you can call me 24 hours a day. Like, I would always look after them.
So, pretty impactful guy, not just at the network, but on the whole industry, wouldn't you say?
Oh, for sure. And I think Stuart, in his, you know, he fell into the same issue as I did, just in a different way, because, you know, he was kind of bringing a hip hop culture to SportsCenter that hadn't existed really before, and did his thing, and it succeeded, and people liked it, and, you know, he kind of crossed some barriers in doing so. But yeah, if he were here to tell the story, I think he'd say something similar. Like, it took a while for them to finally trust, like, hey, let me be me, you know, because that's the thing. So many people kind of put on an act, and then you find out, oh, that's actually not even who they are. They're just, this is the little show, and which is fine if that's how they're succeeding. I think the way I'm talking to you right now is same thing I used to do on SportsCenter, except I wore a tie and, you know, had to get some names right and facts correct.
Back then, there certainly was a feeling that a host, what made a host was some shtick, if you will. Do you think that's true today?
Well, I think everybody tries to differentiate, you know, like, be impactful in whatever way they express it. I guess I'm not a huge fan of the so-called hot take things, where every day you got to say something so big and powerful that, you know, people are talking about it on Twitter or whatever. Like, I was just like, old school Sports Center. Here are the games. Here's our hopefully entertaining highlight of the game. Here's the interview with the star of the game. You know, just the immediacy. Like, that was truly what was fun until the last day. I mean, it would still be fun to do now, is Steph Curry hits a three to win a game, or some guy throws a no-hitter, and we have 90 seconds sometimes to figure out what in the hell we're going to do to cover. Like, I remember distinctly one of my last shows, I forget what date, but there were a bunch of no-hitters that year, and it seemed like every other night some guy was throwing a no-hitter for that month of May. Anyway, Evan was my producer, Evan Anderholm, and the scenario was, you know, the guy's in your ear saying, all right, if he comes immediately for the interview, we do that. If he's not ready for the interview, we'll show the highlight, short highlight or long highlight. If that doesn't happen, we're going to go back to the broadcast team. You know, so we had like five different things that might or might not happen. And we had to trust Now we're down to 30 seconds. Now we're down to the tees. Now we're down to we're on the air. And we still don't know as we're saying, hey, everybody, welcome to SportsCenter. We still don't know what we're doing. And then he says, go to the interview. All right, joining us now is Joe Blow, who just threw a no-hitter. You know, and I mean, that part was always fun. So I think to me, that was always the essence of the network and also the thing I like to do the best, probably, other than like the traveling features. But today's market, it seems like people are out to get noticed, but I guess why not, right? If you get noticed, you get more fans and more attention and more money. So, but it just wasn't ever my thing. I'm going to make a big, bold statement about so-and-so is not an elite quarterback or whatever the hell. Like, that just, that stuff never did it for me. As much as I love football, the arguments about, you know, who's elite or, you know, just watch the course of a football season, how many times people change their opinion on which team is good. Start there, right. You know, September good, October good, you know. So, but on the other hand, you have to also realize mostly you're filling time between commercials. So you got to come up with what's a good 12 minutes that we can do that will keep people listening. So they get to decide it how they want to decide it.
So clearly you developed relationships within the walls of ESPN. What about with the athletes and coaches in the game? Any special relationships developed there?
Oh, I mean, Jamal Crawford would be a standout. Sue Bird, you know, a lot of different people in football because NFL in particular, for about 10 or 12 years, I did this little dumb thing we called the main event, and it would be on Sunday Countdown. And so for 22 straight weeks, we would travel to one team or another and make up either take a real story and kind of go off the cliff with it, or make up a story, just literally, hey, we're going to do a fictional story about blank and you're going to Tom Brady. Here's your line. We did one about Tom Brady and Justin Bieber. Bieber was stealing Tom Brady's look was the joke, or Brady was stealing Bieber's look. That was the joke. I'm sorry. Had it backwards. Because at the time, if you remember, Brady had really long hair. I mean, it was down to here. And we somehow got Bieber's people to say yes. We fly to, I think it was at San Jose at a concert, got him in pre-show. He was very funny. He was only like 14 or 15, but he was perfect. He, you know, he played his role. Then we went back and got Brady, and then we married it all together. I mean, that's just an example of, you know, here's 3 minutes we hope is funny. And as we did that, you know, you got to know the people because you were working with them in a different way. They're so used to being up at a podium or getting grilled after a game, you know, why did you not make that tackle? Or the reverse of, why are you guys so good? They were used to the he's good, he's bad type of interviews. And we were doing something totally different. We were like, hey, we got a little skit. You're our actor. Here's your line. Some guys were good enough to do their own lines. A lot of them, just say your name. We'll just use, you know. But it's funny. All in all, they were pretty damn good. I mean, football players, you know, most of them did most of their college years, you know, fairly well-educated group. You got to be pretty smart to play in the NFL. So I thought we had a really good stable of actors, if you will. But it was funny which teams would be agreeable because some teams just like, we're not screwing around. We're not doing these jokes, you know, because they didn't want the problem of they join in on one of my dumb stories and then they get blown out that day. And then people could say, yeah, you guys are screwing around doing a dumb story on Wednesday. But I was like, my thing takes like 10 minutes. You're going to instead submit to the hour-long breakdown interview where they're, you know, trying to get into your psyche about your game face or whatever. So we always had the Seahawks because I had a relationship there. Packers were always really good. Minnesota was always really good. And strangely, New England with Belichick was pretty agreeable. Every year we did one or two bits over there.
So there was a kerfuffle, if you will, this year where, you know, one of your former, I believe, no, maybe not one of your former colleagues, but it came out wrong, as she said, that things kind of got made up from the sideline report that coaches may or may not have said on a football game, you know?
Yeah, I honestly.
What was your reaction to that?
Well, I mean, you saw the quick reaction from those who hold that job. They're like, no, we don't. We get real interviews and report real stuff. I mean, I think everybody has generalized on it when you had to, right? When you didn't have the genuine article next to you, but through your other talks during the week, you could kind of surmise this is how they feel about blank, right? Like, I don't want to speak for her or criticize her for, I think she said it wrong for opener. She probably didn't mean it.
Well, that's why I said it. She said it. That's why I asked you that way. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I just stayed out of that one. Like, I think most people including her work hard and do their job and try to get the research. The sideline thing is sometimes a thankless, you're just begging for anything, you know, and like so-and-so gets hurt and you're talking to the assistant trainer. Can you tell me, is it knee or ankle? You know, so they don't have it the easiest in the first place, and they got to be quick with it. Right. But I can't tell you. I mean, I will say this. Stuart told me a story where he was a local news reporter and there was like a hurricane wherever he was working in Florida or somewhere. And I think he had his audio guy kind of like shake the tree a little bit behind him because the wind had died down. I think Stuart would be okay that I told that story. Here I am doing the football stories. We admitted we were making them up. It wasn't journalism. It was comedy, you know? So at the same time, that was kind of a weird situation for me sometimes, because then there were bosses who didn't think that I had the standing to go do a serious story, because he's the guy that does all those silly stories. But I was always like, well, I can be serious about serious things and less serious about less serious things. Like, I think I can do both. I still do both things today, right? Like,
yeah,
can make jokes and we can talk serious about politics, or we can, you know, like, it's okay to be able to be multifaceted.
So I have a 21-year-old male in the house. He's about to be a senior in college. Sports fanatic. He shares sports content with me through various social media channels. He's home right now. I never see from him, ever. I never see him watching highlight shows. They're never on our television. Everything's through Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, etc. We live in a digital age. What do you think the future of your old medium is tomorrow?
Well, I think tomorrow it's doing fine. I mean, look at all these big money deals. Didn't they just sign some $1 trillion deal with the NBA, right? The rights.
They're about to. They're certainly about to. $76 billion.
Well, agreed. Yeah. And regular TV ain't going away. I think that whole thing's been overplayed. Is it getting minimized? Of course it is, because there are so many more opportunities to watch different ways. I mean, I grew up with ABC, NBC, CBS, PBS, and then there was Channel 13, which came in and out, and then there was a UF, VH, whatever it was, the other weird channels. So can you imagine being an old timer, you know, somebody who's in their like 90s right now that used to be an executive at one of the big ones? They're like, we used to have a third of the country every night, 33% of the country would watch just us. Now everybody's just fighting for like smaller, you know, like if you get 1 million people to watch anything, that's now a big deal in the country of 330 million. So the other point is, a lot of those things your kid's watching on his phone might have come from TV in the first. It might be a cut down clip of something that was on regular TV. So I think the death of TV is overplayed. They're still selling commercials. Everybody's still watching. You're not sitting there watching the NBA Finals on your phone. I mean, I guess some people do, but that's not as good a screen.
I'm talking more specifically about highlight shows. You're all the four of those.
Well, they don't need them in the way they did need them, because in the old days, like when I first came up on ESPN, unless you lived in the city and watched it on your local TV or went to the game or heard it on radio, because the internet didn't even, you know, wasn't. It was starting, but not everybody had. I didn't have a computer till 1998 or something, you know. So, yeah, like if you wanted to know, let's say you cared about, you know, the Phillies and Cubs game or whatever, you needed to watch at 11 o'clock and see whoever was going to tell you what happened. And now you can get it immediately. But I think there's still something to being, you know, admiring a way a certain person does the show. Like, people go out of their way to watch Scott Van Pelt. He's very clever. He's very funny. He's got a cool show. And he's just one of many. Like, I want to hear how Scott called that game. I want to see, I just watched the game, but now I want to watch him call the game because I want more of that game. So I think there's still something to the attraction of hearing a show and watching it play out.
So as a football player, former football player, excuse me, do you think, I had this discussion with some friends the other night. I feel like, and maybe we're just old, Kenny, maybe that's just the answer, but it feels to me like the personalities of yesterday have evaporated and that the player today is very different. The era that you and I grew up in watching had much more in-depth, bigger, nice football, by the way. Those of you not watching,
I have a side story about that. So whenever I do really anything, like if I'm writing or being interviewed, I like something, I like dice or a football. Just, it's like a pacifier.
No, it's all good. And he's fidgeting with a football, with an NFL football.
Yeah, this ball I stole from NBC. Kerry Champion and I did the Olympics for Peacock 3 summers ago. It was the 20 Olympics, but held in 21, right? Yeah. And I walked in the makeup or wardrobe one night, and I saw this football. And I said, what's that for? Like, is the prop? What's going on? And I just announced, I think you guys underpaid me. I'm stealing this football. And they all like, cool, it's your ball. So
again, like, it seems to me that the personas were larger back then.
Yeah, but
am I wrong?
No, I haven't thought about that so much, but I think with you posing it, I think it's that there are so many big personalities and they all have their own social media. And a lot of them, you know, have their own production companies. So it's not outstanding. It's not remarkable when somebody has a big personality. Whereas in the old days, they had to go through the conventional media. So the guys that had big personalities stood out because the other guys were just the meat and potato blocker tackler guys, right? And there were a handful that had these oversized, you know, the Deion Sanders back in the 80s or whoever. I think it's more that. I think it's that there are so many more personalities now, and they're all doing it in their own way, that nobody stands out in the way that they once did when there weren't as many.
Interesting.
I'm only answering it because you brought it up. That's my guess. I don't know.
Well, you're only answering because I asked it, right? Yeah. So anyways, are you still a sports fan? Do you watch a lot of sports?
I do. I come and go. Like, I watched all the NBA finals. I watched all the NCAA tournament. I'm not killing myself to watch on a Thursday. Even the Mariners, who are doing great, I'll watch them when I can, but I'm not like, I have to watch Mariners Twins tonight. I might be watching a movie with Gretchen, right? Like, I kind of get to pick and choose. NFL still is my number one by far. As far as something like weekly, I want to know what's happening, and I care about watching even games that aren't the Seahawks. But yeah, the necessity of doing it is out because I don't have to pass any quiz anymore. I'm kind of more doing one-off spot projects than I am having to go in at 11 o'clock and call highlights.
So you and Gretchen, your wife, started the Run Freely Foundation to help veterans with prosthetic orthotic devices. Can you tell us what inspired that and what impact it's had so far, given your experience with ankle pain and exosim devices?
Yeah, well, I mean, I broke my leg on the last play of a game my junior year at UNLV. We were at Oregon. I was second string. I was starting to play a little bit more, but we were getting murdered, and I'm in there to mop up the game. For some reason, hey, let's try to score one more time, even though we're going to lose, you know, the last gasp throw. It was a terrible throw. It was kind of drizzly. I remember the ball slipping. I didn't get a lot on it. And just as I released it, some guy stuck his helmet on my right ankle. And another guy kind of stood me up, so it was even worse. I was kind of like standing up and then twisting over. And anyway, I had what was called a fracture dislocation. They didn't think I was going to play the next year, but they were going to let me finish my scholarship and finish my degree. But I ended up somehow rehabbing kind of on my own, just kind of did my own thing to get myself back. And surprisingly, came back and played my last year. Again, I was second string to a guy named Sam King, who led the nation in passing yards that year. Randall Cunningham was a freshman on our team. He ended up redshirting, but technically I can say I was ahead of him, even though that's true. So year by year, decade by decade, my ankle got worse and worse. And I finally met this guy in Gig Harbor, Washington, named Ryan Blanc at the Hanger Clinic. And he had invented this crazy device. It looks like it's for your knee. It goes like way up to your thigh. But what it does is it takes the pressure. It displaces the pressure off your bad joint. So like I just played golf last night, had a good round, no pain. If I had worn regular golf shoes, I'd be limping for 3 days. Like my ankle's ruined. But this thing, it basically lets your bad ankle go along for the ride, I guess is the best way to put it. And you just do your thing. You can run. I can play flag football. I do sprints. I can do squats. I can do whatever. I just got to wear my brace. But Gretchen and I both said right away, let's do something good since we got this blessing. Because I remember I cried for like literally 2 hours. I couldn't even talk to her on the phone. I couldn't believe I was running on a treadmill on day one. Like, it's crazy how well it worked. And I'd have to count it up. I think we're over 50 over the 4 years. We've helped that many veterans get one of those devices and do the same stuff I'm doing. So we basically just tell stories like this. Runfreely.org, R-U-N-F-R-E-E-L-Y, runfreely.org. And I always say, tell your rich friends. Safeway is giving us a nice donation. That was very kind of them. I'm playing in their golf tournament next week out in Suncadia. And we just, now and then, somebody cool comes along and throws a good amount at us. And that takes nothing away from the people that send $10. You know, that could be a lot to them. So it always adds up. Every time we get to the right number, I call Ryan and say, hey, we're good. Who's next? And we find out who needs it most and who's hurting the most. And we figure out who's next.
Well, that's awesome. You spent 27 years at the mothership, as they used to call it, I believe. I think that was what Dan Patrick used to call it.
Yeah.
You wrote a very eloquent goodbye about how you are a salary cap casualty. You've recently been covering the Olympics for NBC, doing some work for Caesars. What else are you up to since you left?
Yeah, the Caesars thing happened right after I left ESPN. I had 50 phone calls about, you want to do this? And a lot of them were kind of like startup. Hey, would you join us on this project? And I kind of spent that first summer, like I did a commercial or two. I did the Olympics for Peacock. And then Caesars made the most sense. I did that for a couple of years. That thing is over now, but we left on good terms. I made a movie called Wiffle Ball, and that's going to be in the Seattle Film Festival Wednesday, June 26th.
Nice.
And funny, mine is the first movie of the festival. It's like a 5-day festival, and it's at an old folks home, a retirement facility, I think they call it. But perfect, because like they tried to retire me, but I'm still going. So, and what they're doing is like what are they calling it? Films across generations, or, you know, like including the senior center is one of the venues. And they're also going to be at the Grand Illusion, old school Seattle film house. And so we're trying to sell that or get it distributed in some way. We're halfway home to a deal with somebody. I'm also potentially got a thing going with Smartless. That's the Jason Bateman and Will Arnett crew, yeah. That not with them, but under them, so to speak. I'm always working on the next thing. I got a couple commercials in play right now, so we're still paying taxes.
And are you, for lack of a better word, mine, at peace with how things ended at ESPN?
Yeah, now it's been so long. I mean, it's funny because If you've been there as long as I was there, and I'm still friends with, I play golf with one of their producers that was my Sports Center producer all the time. I see him almost every week and talk to a bunch of others, Buchagross and John Anderson, who's leaving soon. You know, we'll trade funny notes all the time. So I've still kept all those good relationships. Scott Van Pelt, I mean, the list is long. Stan Verrett, Michael Leaves, on and on and on. But I miss the hour. Like I miss the making up a funny thing to say over a highlight or the catchphrases or whatever, the lead-ins, the immediacy, the adrenaline that we talked about earlier. But I don't miss having to go in at 4:30 for a meeting and coming home at 2 a.m. and being dead tired and doing it again and again. So I did it enough. I like the stuff we're doing right now. I'm definitely not done trying to do more things. Like, I'd be bored. I don't like golf that much. And plus, we have another daughter going to college. So, yeah, we have high overhead. We need to keep bringing it in.
So you covered a lot. You did it all on sports. Give me a couple highlights. 27 years. What are your highlights?
It'd be like if I made a top. I always answer the first, like, what's the coolest thing you did or whatever. I think it's Stevie Wonder at Live 8, not Live Aid, but Live 8, they called it. And it was a big mission by artists to try to get the Western G7 countries to relieve some African debt. So they had these concerts around the world. I think it was a 1 day or 2 day thing. I can't remember. Kind of like Global Citizen-ish, you know. And Stevie was playing in Philadelphia, and I think he was the last act. And I talked to my boss. I was doing the baseball all-star game. I was always in that softball game for a bunch of years. And I said, can I go down to Philadelphia and try to get Stevie just for a quick interview that we'll then use in Detroit, because he's from Saginaw.
Yeah.
And he's like, Tim Scanlon was his name. He ran baseball. And he's like, I got to tell you, I got nothing set up. I don't even have a credential. I don't have a camera. I got nothing. I think it might have been the night before. It was either the night before, or the night before, or the night before. And he's like, do it. It can't be that bad. Go for it. And so it took me like 15 hours to figure out how to get to him. I had this flimsy little media pass that only got me into a tent about 6 blocks away. I'm nowhere near Stevie Wonder. But some teamster who was doing security or setting the barricades up or whatever he was doing, he sees me and he said, what are you doing here? And I tell him the whole story. And he gives me a lanyard. He had an extra one. So now I'm backstage. I've gone from nowhere to backstage. I get to one of Stevie's people and told him the bit. I want to do this quick little interview. He said, I'll tell you what, you stand right here. And when Stevie's done, he's going to walk this way to his car. You'll get 1 minute to pitch him. He'll either do it or he won't. And Stevie Wonder, I got him to say, I can't be at the baseball all-star game. I have a high ankle sprain. That was a victory, like all-timer. However, I didn't execute it great when it came time to air it. I didn't love my performance on that. It was in the middle of a softball game that kind of threw down to me. And I wanted to set it up to have it be pure comedy, but instead I got into gushing about how great Stevie Wonder is. And here's the soundbite, whatever. But at least we got him to do it. I'd say being at Dale Earnhardt's Daytona 500 win, and then later being the one who kind of wrote the obituary when he passed away. I mean, all the football stuff was great. The wider world of sports, where we traveled the world and went to the Palio and Irish Road bowling, all that stuff was a huge highlight. Main Street, getting to work with Aubrey Plaza and Alison Becker and Ben Schwartz and John Glazer, Chris Smith, Ben Stiller, you know, Mulaney, I think, was in one. That was a really cool period. So it was funny because it was sectionalized, like, you're doing Main Street for 2 years. You're doing Wider World for a year and a half. You're doing, you know, but I don't regret any of it. I wish they had kept some of them going longer. For whatever reason, they killed this one or that one. It was above me, but just getting to do it was pretty cool.
The relationship between the athlete and media has changed dramatically. COVID really changed things when media weren't at games. Social media, the athlete now can control their own voice. They almost don't need the media.
Yeah.
You think that's a good thing or a bad thing for the fan?
Well, I guess I look at it more from the player's perspective. I think I've always been sort of pro player as opposed to pro management.
That's why I'm asking you the question.
Yeah. Like whenever there's a big dispute or a player's demanding more money, it's like, well, you guys know if Bill Belichick had found a better guy than Tom Brady, they would have cut Tom Brady. Like that's that. Right. I think that's the easiest way to explain it when.
No question.
And that's just the way it is. It's vicious business. You know, all the pro sports are big, you know, highly competitive, a lot of money involved. Everybody wants to succeed. The thing about the players taking control of, it's a little bit like the whole NIL in college, which I'm okay with. It's kind of wild, wild west, but coaches get to sign these deals with big outs if they get a different job or they get fired and keep another 20 million. And, you know, why can't the players? The thing I always compare it to is if you were a music student on scholarship, you're on a music scholarship, nobody ever said you can't go make an album. Nobody ever said you can't go do a concert. But when it came to the athletes, It was like, how dare you consider doing anything more than just getting your scholarship and your $400 a month or whatever it was, you know? I think that you started, or maybe I read a different question into all of that as well. There was always that concern about getting too close if you're covering somebody. Like, anybody should readily admit, if you're the beat writer for the Seahawks, you'd much rather they go to the Super Bowl than go 4 and however many games they're playing these days. Right? Like, it's more fun to be associated with a successful team, and you're kind of rooting for them, but then you still try to write an objective piece. And I think most people do a pretty good job of that. But, you know, humans are humans. You can't not kind of fall for somebody over time if you've been around them a bunch of times and get to know them in a different way. Like, Doug Baldwin and I are friends. Jamal Crawford and I are friends. Right? But if I had to do a story about them back when I was doing it, I think I could still fairly criticize them if they needed it, or praise them if they needed that. But there is something to that, where you see that in politics even worse, right? The access journalism. You know, we're going to write a favorable story about, you know, Trump has reset, and he's, what do they always say? He's pivoting.
Right.
And it's like, no, he's not actually pivoting. But because that reporter wants to get the next interview, they sometimes sell the story in a way they probably shouldn't. So I think everybody has to be warned about that in journalism, about cozying up to your, you know, like you go to an event back when I did local news, and the PR lady gives you the press release and gets you the right interview and you get a free lunch. And next thing you know, man, I want to make this good because that person's, you know, like, you got to steer from that and try to stay objective the whole way if you're doing a real story. Now, if you're doing a piece of comedy, I think it's totally different.
So let me ask the question a different way. You worked with John Clayton. You worked with Chris Mortensen. You worked with others who had incredible relationships with coaches, players, etc. Obviously, because they became insiders. They were very good at what they did. They had information and access before anybody else did.
In today's the same way, yeah. Schefter,
correct.
Yeah.
Correct. That access comes as a result of trust. People know that those guys aren't going to blab that Kenny Mayne was their source at UNLV or as a Seahawk, right? That is a product of trust. What I understand is going on today is that there is, you know, players, first of all, control their own devices, so they don't need that relationship. They can go onto Instagram, Twitter, Snapchat, TikTok, whatever. But more importantly, the teams themselves control things so tightly that the access to the players is so limited that the media has a much harder time creating those relationships to generate that trust to do their jobs. Now, obviously, guys like Woj and Schefter are doing their thing, but beat reporters, et cetera, are having a much more difficult time writing stories because they don't have the access anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's still some mandated access, right? The locker room has to be open for 30 minutes, but guys know how to stay in the hot tub longer, right? Like, there's ways to avoid or pop out for two questions and they fulfilled their duty. I don't know, it never bothered me. Like, Marshawn was a great example, and it was so funny how he was mischaracterized so wrongly. Like, he's a bad guy because he won't talk to the media. It's like, nah, you got all the wide receivers will always talk, all the DBs, they'll always talk. You know, the prima donnas are going to talk, and the quarterback's always going to talk, coach is always going to talk. You got enough to write a story, and if some guy doesn't want to talk, it never bothered me. I don't know if what you're saying is completely true about the lack of access, because they still do, you know, the podium time and there's still one-on-one time. Like, if you're a Seahawk beat guy or girl, you know, you go up to the PR staff, hey, I want to get, and usually say it by number, you know, I want 7, 15, and 88, you know, whoever they are. And they go to the player, hey, can you go talk to so-and-so for 5 minutes as you walk out? I think that's still mostly happening, but I agree with what you're saying, that the player now knows he or she doesn't have to tell it all. That's not their only conduit to get their story out. They can give the interview they give and then run to Instagram and do the thing they want to do. But it's a new world. Like, it's there's more ways to get out, which also then is in a tangent is true for the young person trying to get into the business. It might seem really hard, but the truth is you can start your own website while you're in college or even high school. I always tell young kids, like, why don't you just start your own website, YouTube page, whatever, and go cover like your high school's game and do a really cool post-game interview with the star of the game and tell about what happened in the game and put that up. And you can be doing right now at age 15 or whatever stuff I didn't get to do till I was 25. Like, you're going to be so far ahead of it as far as polishing, you know, your skill set and making your mistakes early. And you also technically 8 billion people might watch it, you know, probably won't, but the potential audience is there for anybody, right?
He is Kenny Mayne. He used to be on your TV show every night for 27 years. I was fortunate to run into him at the Queen Anne Beer Hall. I would say it's one of the greatest sports bars in the country, not because it's the most beautiful, just because it works. It's here in Seattle. It's a great place if you're here in town, especially if you're going to a Kraken game. When the Sonics are back, I'm sure people will be going there as well. We saw each other before a Springsteen show. It was a fantastic concert, by the way.
That was a good show. I was so glad I bought the seat. I bought last minute. I was in town for a different reason. Didn't even know he was in town until I got to town and just went on whatever, Ticketmaster, StubHub, somebody. But I bought what they call bar seats.
Right.
Not because there's a bar. It was because
there's a bar in front of you. There's literally a bar in front of you.
Yeah. And a miniature table. And uh-huh. I got this ruined ankle. So when I go to a concert, like I'm going to Pearl Jam coming up soon, and that's a long time. By the time you walk around outside,
yeah,
get in line, walk in, you're standing for most of the show, right? People don't sit through those shows. Like, that's wear and tear. So I wear my leg brace for those. But at the Springsteen, I remember just, oh God, this is awesome. I get to lean against something here. But Bruce is amazing. I've seen him, I guess, just twice. And I wish more. He sings, somebody took this so wrong on Twitter. He came up somehow. And I said something like, that man sings every song like it's the last song that will ever be sung. And they thought I was criticizing. I said, no, that's a right. High compliment. My meaning is his energy and his effort level is as good as anyone's. And the music's great.
Well, that's how we met. I've chased you for a while to get you to do this. I'm very appreciative, as is the audience. I hope that we can have you back on during football season. I'm sure there'll be lots to talk about then. And I thank you so much for doing this.
I have a Canadian reference since you brought that up earlier.
Okay, let's hear it.
When did you leave Canada?
Well, so I left Canada the first time in 90 to go to college in Vermont, as I told you earlier. I've been back twice.
So you'll know the reference.
I've been here for 10 years this time.
But you were in Canada in the 80s. My good friend, Jimmy Sandusky, standout wide receiver, Edmonton and Vancouver. And was he somewhere else? I can't remember. But he was All-America in JC at UNLV, then at San Diego State. And then he had this great Canadian career. He's old like me, but he's still athletic. He's now a pickleball star. He's in the national championships of pickleball coming up for his age group.
You do know, Kenny, that the greatest moment in Simpsons history is Homer falling asleep on the couch watching the CFL draft, right? Like, that is. Anyways, he's Kenny Mayne. Thank you for spending some time with us. Really, truly enjoyed this. And we hope to have you again soon sometime.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you to Kenny Mayne for joining me in today's episode of The Press Row. He was absolutely fantastic. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Just an incredible career, 27 years on SportsCenter, doing some really interesting things. Make sure you check out his movie, Wiffle Ball. It is in the Seattle Film Festival. Lots of cool things coming on. I'm sure you're going to see him all over the place. As always, please subscribe to The Press Row on your favorite podcast network or on YouTube. You can follow me on all of your favorite social media channels at YYZ Sports Media. If you'd like to get in contact, you can direct message me there or send me an email at Jonah at YYZ Sports Media.com. And if you want to appear as a guest or advertise, you can send an email there as well. Thank you once again, and we will see you next time. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Believe. You can show support to your host by subscribing to the show and giving us a 5-star rating on your preferred platform. Check us out at Believe.com and search for BLEAV on YouTube.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.